So, what is a mitochondria?
You've taught me a few things about mitochondria, but I'm definitely not the one to tell you what it is.
It's this kind of words that we hear very often, and mostly in biology and advanced research on DNA and etc. But people have a very simplistic idea what it is. So, what I would like to do is to try to give an overview of what it
Okay,
is.
so in a nutshell, what would you say to us is mitochondria?
So, the mitochondria is the power generation of our cells. Our cells have evolved. So, if we stick to the evolution of life on this planet under the guidance of God, according to his laws, he has devised a certain process for life to develop. From very simplistic cells until very complex forms, more and more complex as we go through the millions of years. At the beginning, monocells, and they were using energy. So each cell is an enclosed organism that needs energy to make chemical reactions happen. These chemical reactions in any living organism, whether they can be plants or animals, it's what we call the currency energy of the cell. It's a molecule called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. So let's not go into nerdy words, but you need, each time you put two molecules together and you want them to interact to create a protein, to break a protein, to create a hormone, to make some passage through cells. Each time you need an energy, you need this molecule of ATP to be close to the two or three or several molecules to provide energy to the reaction. Okay, it's like basically finding a plug of electricity in a wall, because when this molecule of ATP is close and is needed to release electrons, this is electricity, it will break up one phosphate and provide electrons.
So what is mitochondria?
So, in order to living organisms to live, you need this ATP. There's two ways a cell can produce ATP. Historically, until 1.5, 1.6 billion years ago, all cells were living on fermentation of glucose, of sugar. But with this reaction, which is called glycolysis, there are seven steps of breaking the glucose into ATP. But with one molecule of glucose, you get three ATPs. Okay? 1.5 billion years ago, it is hypothesized that one cell has been integrated within the other cells, and this cell is a mitochondria. But these mitochondria are very efficient in producing energy, because with one glucose, they can produce 36 ATPs. So it's much more efficient in producing energy for our cells.
And the glucose we're talking about, is that the natural glucose that our body produces, or are we talking about like sugary stuff
No,
that
no.
everybody loves?
So at the end of the day, either we eat things and they transfer, we call it carbohydrates, and at the end they end up in two things, glucose or fructose. Okay, but our bodies, our liver is producing glucose on demand,
Of its own.
on its own, and we don't need any external influx of any glucose.
In fact, we shouldn't be putting in any external forms of glucose or fructose. Is that correct?
Knowing that our whole vascular system contains only 5 grams of sugar, a piece of bread can contain up to 20 grams of sugar. So our body is very overwhelmed by this sugar, and the glucose itself, we know that is very deleterious to the body. It caused glycation of cells. It's creating havoc and destruction within the body. It's a toxin that is used as a fuel, but it has to be controlled in its level, and it's done through insulin, right? So what's happening is that our bodies can work on two fuels, fats, so it's called ketones. These are fat bodies, let's say, or glucose, right? The mitochondria can use both.
Mm-hmm.
And the glucose is burned preferably very quickly because it is so dangerous for the body that the body wants to get rid of it as soon as possible to get the level of sugar at an acceptable level for it.
The external sugar that we put into our body.
Any sugar. But...
So when mitochondria is at its peak healthy state, it's the optimal energy and we feel our best.
Exactly. Everything is determined by, and this is, you know, research that have been going on for the past, I would say 20 years, but more and more we understand that the idea that our cells are governed by a nucleus, and within this nucleus there is our DNA, mm-hmm. that is like the chief orchestra of all the what's happening in our body.
Yeah.
We more and more understand that this is not the case. That the real chief orchestra of the activity of our cells and of our processes is the mitochondria. The mitochondria is determining the cell division and is providing all the energy needed for anything that happens in the cell. In one cell, you have 1 million every second chemical reactions, right?
So why are we hearing the narrative that the DNA is performing this role when actually the mitochondria is more critical to this narrative?
Well, when DNA was discovered, medicine, there was an hypothesis that it was driving everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we know it is called, even today in school of medicine, when you learn the role of DNA, they call it the central dogma.
Right.
Of medicine. Yeah. The dogma is that you have a DNA within the nucleus of the cell. This nucleus is within the enclosure of the cell. And there is RNA messengers that would take information from the DNA, go out of the nucleus into some factory production to produce the proteins you need, right?
Right.
This is a central dogma. Mm. And there's a very interesting anecdote because it was said until the beginning of the 70s that there was absolutely no information that could go from outside the DNA and be inscribed into the DNA. The DNA was received by from your parents, and you could never be changed except through replication errors, mutations, right? That happened randomly. This was the basic. But in the beginning of the 70s, people have been discovering what is called the retrotranscriptase, mm-hmm. which is that some information, RNA information, can be inscribed within the DNA. So you have this double movement. And the chief of the Pasteur Institute at the time, when he was reading the paper of one of the researchers of the Pasteur Institute, Beljansky, who discovered transcriptase, inverse transcriptase, he said, as long as I am the director of the Pasteur Institute, reverse transcriptase will not exist. And this is how strong they felt about the way things work.
It was an inconvenient truth that they just didn't...
Yeah,
want to bother with.
Because it was a shattering of the whole view.
Of course.
Right?
It shatters their whole narrative on the whole DNA proposal.
Yeah. Then we, probably around 10 years ago, the discovery of epigenetics,
mm-hmm.
which is that it's not only sufficient that you have the DNA. The DNA is like a blueprint with let's say, recipes for producing many things in your body. But these recipes, you need to act on them.
Mm.
And whether these recipes are being cooked or not depends on your environment, on your level of stress. It's called epigenetics.
Right.
So basically think about the DNA as the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And epigenetics is whether you are pressing the trigger or not.
Okay.
So when we are said that, oh my God, there is a mutation in this part and you have a gene that is very bad, well, they understand more and more that it is bad if it is triggered.
Mm-hmm.
And many times you can make an intervention in your way of living or mm-hmm. in your nutrition that prevents the triggering of this thing that could be dangerous.
So coming back to mitochondria, what role does it play in layman's terms in our life and in influencing all of these factors?
Yes. This is like the wild the West, you know?
Yeah.
It's a cowboy country. There's a lot of research and we are just starting to scratch the surface. But what we know is that our body health of any living organism health depends on the health of the mitochondria. For example, all cancers, they have one thing in common. For a long time, and since the 50s or the 40s, cancer has been thought of as a mutation of the DNA that prevents a control of the replication of the cell. Except that when you take a tumor of any cancer, some of the cells have this mutation and some other cells are normal, but they still behave the same way. So the anomaly in the DNA is not the common factor in all the cancer cells. The common factor is really that mitochondria are not functioning.
Wow.
And they are not functioning. It means that ATP needs to be produced the old way before mitochondria existed, which is through fermentation. And only glucose can be used. This is why ketogenic diets, when you starve the body from all these external sugars, you starve the cancerous cells from much of the fuel they need to grow.
I think we need to do a talk on the dry fasting that you taught me, which has really turned around my energy levels, and just, it's so superior to anything that I've ever done. But coming back to mitochondria and the ATP, so what are some of the things that we can be aware of that we can do and be proactive to keep our mitochondria optimal?
Yeah, this is a field of research that is developing. There is, and this is probably worth an episode, there is hydrogen. So basically, why do we breathe and why do we eat?
Yeah.
From an energy perspective, an energy production perspective. We eat to provide our mitochondria with hydrogen.
Right.
And we breathe so that this hydrogen is being used by the mitochondria and is being captured at the exit of the process by an oxygen, and this creates water, and then the CO2 that we exhale. So the only reason we really breathe is to get this oxygen that will capture two hydrogen to make water, for example, and then CO2. So
the bottom line to our eating and breathing, the bottom line is the mitochondria.
Yes.
That's what it ends up being all about.
Yes. Since
that's remarkable.
The production of energy, until the mitochondria integrated our cells, this production of energy was anaerobic, didn't need any oxygen. Fermentation doesn't need oxygen. But since mitochondria is so efficient, it is the preferred mode of production of energy, but it needs oxygen. And this is why we have oxygen. So a good breathing, is helping the mitochondria, right?
So good breathing would mean when you're going on a rigorous walk, let's say a brisk walk, and you're made to breathe as you walk. So you're breathing deep in and out, or even say a light jog or a hike or something. So that's why staying active alongside eating well, and of course all the other things that we talk about, living well, is critical.
Absolutely.
To a healthy mitochondria.
Absolutely. In fact, all the healthy things we are told, like exercise, breathing correctly, sleeping correctly, all have a link to the health of the mitochondria. Now, we may be lucky and unlucky in our mitochondria, because contrary to the nucleus DNA, which comes from both the mother and the father, and if there is any problem in one chain of the DNA, the mother's corresponding chain can be healthy. The mitochondria only comes from the mother.
Really?
Yes.
It only comes from the mother?
Only from the mother. And it has its own DNA.
Okay.
Which is called mitochondrial DNA. And it's only coming from the mother. And this mitochondria you have in each of your cells are the children of mitochondria that existed in your grandmother's body. Because when a human being, female human being, is born, this baby already contains in her body all the eggs that she's going to use through her fertile years.
Yeah.
And these eggs have been, in fact, produced by the grandmother.
Right. Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
And during the cell division of the when a baby is produced, the DNA is replicated, and you have half from your mother, half from your father, but all the, let's say, the engines within the cells are duplicated from the ovule, from the egg of the mother.
Right.
And this egg contains the mitochondria of the mother. And when the egg divides, when it's fecundated, you know, when it divides in two, you have half of the mitochondria that go one way and half go the other way. If your mother had, let's say, 50% of her mitochondria in bad health, it could be that you inherit, on one side goes 90% of bad mitochondria or badly functioning mitochondria. In this case, the baby will be very unhealthy.
So the grandmother has to make sure that she is extremely healthy or keeps herself optimal in her health in order for even her grandchildren to benefit from her healthy state.
Absolutely.
So it's not just always about what the mother is eating during the pregnancy or even prior to the pregnancy. It really goes back another generation.
Yes, absolutely. It is important for the mother to be healthy and to provide nutrition to so that the baby can grow. But from a genetic perspective, from a seed perspective, the quality of the seed really depends on the grandmother for a girl.
And so that's why it's very important to be aware of what's actually really good for you and what isn't. Because whatever, especially for a woman, you know, you consume, it's going to affect the next two generations of your family.
Absolutely. And I think today, children who are born in the 20s are probably the first generation that are born out of a generation that has been eating these incredibly processed foods, industrial foods, their parents, you know, the baby boomers. The baby boomers themselves, they were raised on very healthy diets generally, let's say, in terms of industrial seed oils, etc. They constructed their body when they were young in a period where all of this was not as available as their children.
You mean seed oils and all these things weren't as available. So therefore, they just by default were a bit healthier.
They got sick, they maybe got heart problems, etc. But their structures were built until they were, you know, teenagers on food that was not that processed and tempered with, right? Their children are the first generation to have been building bodies on crap, on very human-made food, right?
But when we talk about, when we say crap, we mean not only the junk food like the sodas and the cakes and the cookies and the candy and all that,
but we're
talking about the seed oil, but we're also talking about man-made agriculture, right? We know that agriculture has changed over time. And so even the current agriculture, no matter how clean the soil is, how clean the air is, and you know, you have complete control over the way the plants are grown, it's still not good for us.
No, it's still not good. But let's say the problem was compounded over years because the soils are getting poorer and poorer in minerals. So you could go into intensive agriculture and still produce fruits and vegetables. They were nutritious. The body and contains a lot of natural toxins, but the bodies could have this nutrition and still be able to maybe to fight off most of this toxicity. Today, we have, unfortunately, industrial products that are not only not nutritious, but they contain an even increased number of toxins and more potent. With bodies that are less and less healthy because of the mitochondria impact, the mitochondria, it can be measured, that activity, you know, and on all chronic disease, the common factor really is that mitochondria are not providing enough energy for the body to defend itself and to clean itself, to resist and to fight off toxins.
So how do we up the game for mitochondria? How do we make it so that it does give us the maximum benefits?
Well, it's a proper nutrition. And in many, many vegetables, you have oxalic acid, for example, that makes oxalates when it binds with potassium or magnesium. And these can create havoc in the mitochondria. There's also something that is seldomly talked about. It's a hydrogen that is a heavy hydrogen. It's called deuterium. And, you know, concentration of a molecule is measured in millimoles or in moles. It's the measure. So if you say that the concentration of calcium in your body, in your bloodstreams, etc., is like 2 millimoles of calcium. Magnesium is maybe 1 millimole. Nobody will say that calcium and magnesium are not important for the functioning of the body, right? It's important because if you lack those things, you just die.
Yeah.
Now, deuterium, which is a very specific kind of hydrogen, it's an hydrogen, but it's an hydrogen that is 2 times more heavy than the regular hydrogen that is needed for the functioning of a mitochondria.
Right.
Okay. This deuterium is has a concentration of 12 millimole. So it's like 4 times more than magnesium. And nobody talks about it.
Why? Why don't they talk
because
about
it? Because it's a recent discovery.
Yeah.
I mean, what is called the ATP synthesis, which is the way mitochondria produce this marvelous molecule called ATP that we discussed at the beginning, that provides energy to all cellular reactions in your body. The way it's done, and I will make it very simple, because microbiology is a fascinating world and very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. And it's like a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And we are just starting to scratch the surface. But what was discovered, measured, and observed is that how is an ATP molecule produced? It is produced by the mitochondria that has on the surface what is called nanomotors.
Yeah.
These are proteins that turn on themselves at a speed of 6,000 turn per minute.
Right.
It's more than the motor of a Porsche, right? This molecule to turn, the thing that makes them turn is a proton.
Yeah.
Look, an hydrogen is just a proton with an electron to make it stable. So the reaction is that when you eat, the hydrogen in your food goes into your cell. Then there is a Krebs cycle. There is a very complicated biochemical reactions that strip this hydrogen of its electron. And proton is used to make these wheels turn.
Yeah.
They turn very fast. And each time they turn, they produce an ATP.
So the deuterium needs to be low?
Yes, because if one of the hydrogen that goes into these wheels is a deuterium, it creates havoc.
But yet it doesn't need to be nil. The goal is not to have no deuterium,
no.
Right? We need some.
Yes, because I mean these are very advanced research. In the production of ATP, it's an impairment. So you have in all these biological reactions many steps in the biology to make sure that less deuterium as possible are entering these nanomotors. But a level of deuterium needs to be sufficient in the cells, because deuterium concentration in the cell is one of the way the cells is signaled that it can replicate, for example. So if you have no deuterium, you have basically no duplication of the cell.
Okay.
So no growth.
Right.
And you can see that if you plant seeds of the same plant in different pots and you just water the seed with low deuterium water and high deuterium water, you will see the plant with high deuterium until a certain point. Huh? If it exceeds a certain point, it dies. But the low deuterium will grow much lower and less fast.
So our food and our water should be low deuterium. I remember one of the first things that you gifted me when we met was low deuterium water. And I think you got it from the Netherlands, if I'm not mistaken.
From Hungary.
From Hungary.
There's a good company there.
And I remember I drank, you made me drink all the bottles. And I remember it really affected and impacted me positively with my energy levels and the clarity and all that. So is that what we should be feeling when we have low deuterium in our system, or adequate deuterium?
Well, we are meant to maintain a certain level of deuterium, which can be set to 120 parts per million, meaning that our hydrogen within the body and in our water that's within the cells should, if you have 1 million hydrogen, you should have no more than 120 deuteriums. And
right.
This is the optimal level, 120, 130. The water we consume is generally a 150. Mm. But if you drink water with 180, you die.
Wow.
Okay.
So how does one know what kind of water they're drinking?
We don't know.
And but do we have an idea, like certain regions where we get water from have higher deuterium?
Yes, we know that the northern you go.
Mm-hmm, the more north?
Yeah, the more north you go, the less deuterium you have in the environment.
Yeah.
But we are talking about 140 parts per million. Mm. When in the equator, in the water of the oceans in general, we have 150 parts per million. Our bodies are meant to operate around 120.
So around which region should we be trying to get our water from?
So the lower deuterium water we find in Iceland, we find in Greenland.
So if we can find bottled water that comes from Iceland, for example, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yes, it's a good idea, but they are still very expensive. And yeah, and they come late at 140. We still have to bridge this gap of 20 parts per million. And our bodies are equipped to do that. We have our microbiome.
Yeah.
It is hypothesized, and I think it's very convincing, that a lot of activities of a microbiome is a way for our body to discriminate deuterium.
Great. So if we drank water, say, from Iceland, and it's not really optimal, our body will do the rest of the job in yes, lowering the deuterium in that water.
Yes, but I think we shouldn't really... I think the main intervention we can do is our food.
Yeah.
Because the plants, in particular, have the same problem as we do, which is that they need to reduce their deuterium level. It is hypothesized that deuterium content in the atmosphere has increased over the past few hundred years.
So we're breathing it now.
Yeah, and we are consuming it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, hydrogen is probably 70% of all the atoms in this universe is hydrogen.
Yeah.
It's very prevalent. We cannot escape it. It's not a toxic in itself. It is needed, but it must be controlled in its... And you have clinics in the US, in Hungary, that are using deuterium depletion, which is lowering the deuterium levels in people, to cure cancer and metabolic diseases.
You and know, they have. I find that fascinating. I remember you sent me a link a while ago on that. There was a researcher, he was some scientist, and he was talking about how they managed to cure cancer with just lowering the deuterium in people.
Yes.
I don't know why this is picked up on a larger scale by the medical industry.
I have no doubt that this will lead to a Nobel Prize at one point, but you know how science advances. It advances one generation at a time. You have people who are very strongly feeling about the causes of disease, like in cancer research. The big bosses, they have made all their career on the hypothesis that cancer is a DNA problem.
Yeah.
And not a metabolic problem.
And so when that gets challenged, then...
They just dismiss it.
That dismisses their entire theory and their work.
So you need a generation to replace people who have less self-interest in defending a certain position and can look at things objectively, like cancer as a metabolic disease, because once again, cancer is really a non-functioning of the mitochondria. So how do we reduce... And the more deuterium excess you have in your body, the less happy the mitochondria are, and they are functioning very low. They're not producing enough energy so that you can use efficiently all your mechanisms in your body to fight off toxins. Okay, so you're overwhelmed. So the main intervention you can do is to consume food that contain the lower possible deuterium content.
Which are some of those foods?
It happens that the plants, as I told you, have the same problem as we do in reducing the deuterium content.
Yeah.
Because they are facing the same issues, that too much deuterium is impairing their mitochondria. And it happens that when they get rid of their deuterium, they put it in their sugar.
Okay.
So fruits are very high content deuterium.
So we should not be eating fruits,
well,
for sure.
Well, if we have metabolic problems, it's a very bad idea. Because it's not only the problem of the sugar, and we talked about glycation of the cells and the problems that sugar are creating in the body, but we add deuterium. Now, the food that contains the last deuterium possible is meat and fat.
Right.
Okay.
Wow. So wait. Okay. You said fruits are out of the question. What about vegetables? What are greeny, leafy vegetables and other vegetables?
Well, you know, cellulose is still a sugar
uh-huh.
that we cannot digest, but it's still a sugar. It's a chain of glucose.
And all vegetables contain cellulose in a problematic manner, from what you said before.
Yes. And they do, and much more than any animal product.
Okay.
And the thing is, the water that is the most concentrated in deuterium is the water of the oceans and the water of the rivers and of the underwater, under the groundwater.
Okay.
And the fruits and vegetables we were eating until probably 70 years ago were mostly irrigated through water coming from the rain.
Okay.
Since deuterium is a hydrogen that is more heavy than the regular hydrogen, when evaporation happens, the rain is deuterium depleted a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's lower in deuterium than the water that remains in the rivers or in the... So irrigation and the general practice of taking water from rivers or underground and putting it on your crops, it has increased the deuterium level of the plants, of any plants you have.
Okay, so plants are out of the question. Fruits are out of the question. Now you're coming to what? Animal
products in general.
Products, so fatty meats. Yeah, and does it have to be fatty meat? Can it be other types of meat that doesn't contain so much fat?
Well, if you want to avoid any non-necessary increase of deuterium, get rid of all sugars because they are heavy in deuterium. And so, but you need fuel for your body. So fat is the fuel, right? So you need fat.
So fatty meats, and of course, then full fat milk, full fat butter, animal products. Okay. So that there's a shift in the mindset, because a lot of cancer patients believe that they should be eating a lot of plant-based food. That's how they've been programmed.
This is mind-blowing, because we know for a fact that cancer cells are unable to strive if there's no sugar available.
Which comes from plants, the vegetables, all of them, just the fruits.
Absolutely.
Where did this mentality come from? Where were we taught to have plants, especially in cases of cancer? I know a couple of friends and even some relatives, which you know, that have trained themselves, because they're cancer patients, to eat a lot more greens. So why?
I mean, this is the power of hypotheses that became truth because they were repeated often enough.
Yeah.
Like fat.
And yet it's not truth.
No, saturated fat are dangerous for health, for example.
Yeah.
It's something that has been clear that it was the fat hypothesis related to coronary diseases. Yeah. It was just an hypothesis, but it was repeated.
But it was
so
never proven.
No,
it wasn't,
absolutely not.
It wasn't evidence based.
Absolutely not.
Because saturated fats, the fat on our meat and the fatty milk and the fatty dairy, is it has such a robust positive impact on our health that it's a shame that people aren't pointed in that direction.
Absolutely, but there's a lot of conflict of interests.
Yeah.
And the sugar industry, which is basically most of the processed food, companies have a vested interest in trying to divert the attention of the problems created by sugar away.
It affects their bottom line, right? So why
find a scapegoat.
Why would they want to tell you anything other than that? Wow, how do you know all this?
Oh, it's just driven by interest. What makes a metabolism healthy?
Yeah.
You know, and
you're really curious about that? How did you even know that you should be thinking about that?
Well, when you are faced with a friend who is suffering from a metabolic disease.
Yeah.
And this friend is the most intelligent person you know.
Yeah.
And you watch him really struggle against the disease for years and years with the best doctors trying to do something for him. Alternative doctors, classical doctors, all the best people coming over and trying to fix something and couldn't. But he knows much more than all of them combined.
Yeah.
And then he dies.
Oh.
And I got revolted, you know, and I was trying to understand what happened.
Yeah.
And I really regret, it happened probably now 6 years ago. I really regret of not knowing everything I know now.
That's the most painful thing, is that we get our wake-up call when something tragic happens to one of us or our loved ones. And it's so devastating that we finally wake up and decide that we're going to want to learn the truth. And
yes,
because otherwise none of this makes sense.
Yes. So within this paradigm of evidence-based medicine and within the evidence of, you know, biochemical reactions, metabolic pathways, there is really all answers converge towards food intervention as the main driver of metabolic health.